Welcome to Come to the Brink. I'm Zoe Flowers, and this is a space for those of us navigating profound life changes, like loss, trauma, caregiving, and transformation. It's about what happens when everything you thought was solid crumbles beneath you and you're forced to rebuild. If you've ever felt like you're standing on the brink, this is the space for you. Welcome. The body is like the earth. It is land unto itself. It is as vulnerable to overbuilding, being carved into parcels, cut off, overmined, and shorn of its powers as any landscape. The wilder woman will not be easily swayed by redevelopment schemes. For her, the questions are not how to form, but how to feel. The breast in all its shapes has the function of feeling and feeding. Does it feed? Does it feel? It is a good breast. The hips, they are wide for a reason. Inside them, there is a satiny, ivory cradle for life. A woman's hips are outriggers for the body above and below. They are portals. They are a lush cushion. The handfolds for love, a place for children to hide behind. The legs, they are meant to take us, sometimes to propel us. They are the pulleys that help us lift. They are the anillo, the ring for encircling a lover. They cannot be to this or to that. They are what they are. There is no supposed to be in bodies. The question is not size or shape or years of age or even having two of everything, for some do not. But the wild issue is, does this body feel? Does it have right connection to pleasure, to heart, to soul, to the wild? Does it have happiness, joy? Can it say, can it in its own way move, dance, jiggle, sway, thrust? Nothing else matters. There is a line in Intozaki Shange's For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. In the play, the woman in purple speaks after having struggled to deal with all the psychic and physical aspects of herself that the culture ignores or demeans. She sums herself up in these wise and peaceful words. Here is what I have. Poems, big thighs, little tits, and so much love. Wow. So that selection, as always, is from Women Who Run With The Wolves, from my co-narrator, Clarissa Pincola Estes, PhD, Women Who Run With The Wolves, Myths and Stories of the Wild Woman Archetype. So as you all know by now, I pretty much start every interview with a reading from this book, and I just focus on the person that I'm going to interview, and I just open up the page, and it seems to set the theme for the conversation that we're going to have. So, welcome back to Come to the Brink with Zoe Flowers, the space where we gather in truth, where we talk about the grief that lingers, the moments that shape us, and the sacred tools that bring us back to ourselves. And I just love that we ended with that, you know, that that poem from our most recent ancestor, Intozaki Shange. And so today's guest, Ella Stewart, I mean, my goodness, Intozaki, like, Ella, I'm not even introducing you yet, but I'm going to just like break the fourth wall and be like, what? Like artist to artist to artist? Intozaki Shange showing up for us is like wild. So Ella J. Stewart is an award-winning writer, director, actress, and the author of The Invention of Ella J. And it's a powerful chronicle of surviving physical and sexual abuse, betrayal, and a complex legacy of healing. Ella J is a Southern woman raised in Mobile, Alabama. And like so many of us, she turned to art as a way through. She lived many lives, wife, mother, performer, survivor. Her storytelling is intimate, honest, and necessary. And her story mirrored parts of my own. I too experienced sexual abuse as a child. I witnessed violence in my home. I even intervened sometimes between my parents. And like Ella, I found refuge in art. For me, it was acting, and later writing, poetry, plays. But it wasn't until I found the science of mind in the 90s that I started building a spiritual practice that could hold all of me, and that still holds me. So this conversation for me, it's not just an interview. It's a meeting of spirit. It's a meeting of artistry. It's a conversation about survival, and it's a conversation about truth. So yeah, let's get into it. Ella, thank you so much for being here. You've written something so deeply powerful, and I know how costly it is to put your pain on the page. So how are you holding yourself these days?
Well, let me start off. And this happens all the time, but the correct pronunciation is L, is LJ. Oh. No worries. No, it happens all the
LJ.
Time. LJ. LJ, yeah. No worries. It happens all the time. But
okay.
How am I holding myself is a beautiful way of phrasing the question. I'm holding myself in purpose. I'm holding myself in grace and kindness and the self-love that I wasn't giving myself to begin with because of all of the trauma and how that pretty much I was not loving myself. I was not taking care of myself because if I'm receiving this level of trauma, there must be something wrong with me. So how dare I give myself the love and attention and need that that I deserve? So that's how I'm holding myself. I'm holding myself with the amount of intention that everyone deserves to give themselves because I'm valuable and I value me. One of the things that I love to say, oh, I think I'm moving forward, but because I can go off on tangents. But being from the South, and thank you so much for pointing that out, because being from the South and people who are not from the South, they don't understand the type of mentality that comes around with relationships, right? Like, oh, if that's your mother, that will always be your mother. You only get one mother regardless of what that mother has done to you. You must love and respect that mother. That's damaging. And crippling for the mind and the spirit and the soul, especially when they have harmed you so horribly. Yes. So thank you so much for bringing that up, that because that needs to also be an undertone or a foundation of this conversation and how I lived in the crust of that trauma for so long and how it was very difficult to try to even break that generational conditioning because my therapist will always tell me, don't say curse. It's not a curse. People are doing what they want to do. You need to keep that in mind. So it's conditioning of the mind. And I broke that and I'm very proud of myself in that regard. So yeah.
What a powerful framing. Because this is what you're saying, people did what they want to do. And when you call something a curse, I mean, even with a curse, people are doing what they want to do, but there is something that demystifies it when you just say, no, people are acting of their own accord. They're doing what they want to do. And it sort of puts the power, it just like shows that they actually chose to inflict pain.
Yes.
Not some supernatural something that took
some off. Other entity causing it. No, this is something that they, it was their choices.
Mm-hmm. Very powerful. And I think that I feel like that's going to free a lot of people today. I mean, I don't even know how many minutes we're in, but I feel like that's already going to free some folks.
Hopefully, that is a
very important reframing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the beginning. So in the book, you talk about surviving sexual and physical abuse at the hands of your stepfather and with your mother playing a role in that.
Puppeteer.
Say more about that.
So for the longest, I would always hold on to the actual actions of what he was doing and only frame him as the primary abuser and not. My therapist said I was living in delusion when it came down to the relationship of me and my mother. She allowed it to happen. It happened under her roof. She said to my great-grandmother, who's no longer here, and my grandmother told me this, well, she said that she saw him walk into your room naked one night. Just stop that for a second. I'm a mother. I have two daughters. If I ever were to see a man, let alone a man that's not their father or even their father, walk into their room naked at night and feel comfortable and confident enough to share that information with a family member, but still decide to stay with that individual, what am I telling the world or telling my family members? I am the puppeteer. Mm-hmm. Another reason why I say she's the puppeteer is because I did not know that she was framing my existence in a specific way to other people. She was telling others, although she said, you know, what she saw him do, she was telling others that I was crazy and that I make up stories. Once that came to me, and that was on January 19th of 2022, when that was told to me, it was almost like an unlocking of a Pandora's box, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. My mind went, oh, she's also the abuser. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just him. Mm-hmm. This must be cut immediately. And it was. Mm-hmm. That relationship was sullied at that moment. And I haven't spoken to her since.
And can you say a little bit about sort of your family, like your family of origin? Like, what is the, you don't have to go into all of it, right? Because we've already talked about, like, this might be two parts. And we don't want to tell too much, right? Because people need to buy the book. But let's just set the scene a little bit about sort of the backdrop of all this, like how this is able to occur.
Right. When all of this abuse was occurring, it wasn't occurring where I'm from in Mobile, Alabama. It was taking place all the way in Texas. So many, many moons, many miles, not moons, but miles away from my foundation of home. I have two sets of family or relatives. I have those that are connected to my mother, and I have those that are connected to my father. Everyone that is connected to my father, I will say, is my family. There are some that are connected to her that I consider to be only relatives at this point, because they have set up in their mind that, you know, well, she's still your mother. Mm-hmm. You guys, you'll get over it, is the type of response. Mm-hmm. So I want to say this, and then I'll get more into my family. Survivors, this is something that I did not know would come with it. Not only are you going to grieve the relationship that you thought you had with the abuser, mm-hmm. you are also going to grieve the relationship with other members of your family that you thought you had. Absolutely. You thought that once they know the truth of what has happened to you, mm-hmm. they will stand up and rally for you. Mm-hmm. And my situation, no, mm-hmm. right. not at all.
Right.
It's a, oh, you'll get over it. Oh, with time. Oh God. Oh God. Oh God, this and God that. So get prepared for that. When this information was first brought to the forefront, my great grandmother, who's no longer here, said that I should just go get my gun and shoot you. I was there. I was a part of that whole conversation. So she wanted to dead him out altogether. Of course, that did not happen. I was so in love with my mother, I could not see that it was her fault or her doing. I mean, I'm at a young age growing up. The abuse started at the age of 5. It ended at either 11 or 12. I cannot remember which age it was.
Okay.
And I was the one who had to say, stop coming into my room and touching me. Okay. Not her.
Okay.
It's jumping all over the place, but I remember when we were in Texas and she wanted me to record him. Have a conversation with him and record him, him admitting what's happening to you. I did that because that's what she wanted me to do. And at that time, we had one of those floor model TV, you know, those old school floor model TV. Yes. So it has a little slit underneath, a little opening. Yes. So I had the recording under there. I was sitting right by the TV. He was sitting behind me. And I started the conversation. He admitted to it. He also stated that I was the one who initiated it. It was me who wanted it. Mm-hmm. She came in, she did this whole blow up after she listened to the tape, act like she was going to do something day one, day two. After that, it went out the window. Then it was snarks at me, nasty comments to me, them coming in from the mall, everybody having brand new things, me having nothing, just treated like an other. That I don't remember when that was, but that was right before I threatened to harm him with a weapon, which caused me to go back home to Mobile, Alabama before my senior year of high school. So the abuse, although the physical touching had stopped at either 11 or 12, there was still mental and emotional and psychological abuse that was occurring while I was in the home with them. And so then I moved back home with my grandmother my senior year of high school, and I've never lived under a roof with her again since then. Mm-hmm. So my family on her side, even though they knew something was happening, they never knew the specifics or the details until the book came out. And they say, oh, this is so bad, and they're crying. And I'm like, but that's not even half of it. Mm-hmm. That's only a little sprinkle of the things that I experienced. Mm-hmm. But looking back and reflecting on how they really treated me growing up, it was almost as if they constantly wanted to shield me and hold on to me from that and from her. But again, I was so in love with her. I want to go with her. Wherever she goes, I'm going.
So there was some sort of, in your memory, there was an attempt to try to hold you. Even though they didn't know what was happening, they knew something was happening.
They knew something, yes.
And what do you feel the dynamics sort of around your mother's family were? Was this something, because sometimes these things are generational.
I think it is, and I think it could be, and I have not gotten into a space, and I hate that this sounds, if this sounds crass, but I, you know, this is all about taking care of me. Haven't gotten into that space of caring about what the hell has happened to them.
Uh-huh.
Because if I'm sharing to you what has happened to me, it should be you trying to figure out how can I help you get better.
Yeah.
And I don't think that I've received that like I should have.
Yeah.
The whole sweeping shit under the rug was what they were accustomed to doing.
Yes.
And so if I'm showing you that I have the will and the strength to try to break whatever this is that you guys have possibly been going through all these years, come along with me. And that's not what I've gotten from them. So I haven't done the research or had the care to dig into. I've heard little snippets here or there that my mother was, she experienced the same thing like one time or what have you, or she's experienced homelessness. And for the life of me, I just can't, as a mother myself, I can't understand that. For me, it doesn't compute.
Yeah. And again, I don't know what we're going to call these, maybe mini mic drops, mic drop number two, right? Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If you're not receiving what you got as the survivor, as the child that should have been taken care of, right? Then maybe it's not so important about sort of how things came to be.
Yeah. And as an artist, as an actor, as a writer and director, that's what we do, right? When we have these amazing characters, like, oh, but what happened to allow this to, for this character to become who they are, right? To have a better understanding and to bring that character's authenticity out. But baby, when you living in it, it's a different type of animal of what you need to do.
Yeah. And usually it takes a lot of distance to be able to do that look back. It takes a lot to unravel that. So, yeah, I get it. So what was the moment when you knew you had to tell the story?
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was working at a performing arts school, working a basic job. This was before COVID. And one of the employees there, my coworker, said, you know, you have all of this experience, you're doing this basic job just to make money, because I was still pursuing acting full time, but also needing to make money. And she said, you need to write a book. I don't know what it's about, but write something. Mm-hmm. So she was the one who dropped a nugget in my head of writing a book. I have no freaking clue what I was going to write a book about. So I just started writing journal entries on my experiences as an actor in LA, 30 something years old with a husband and a child and da da this and da da that. And then January 1922 happened when I called that my mental revelation versus breakthrough or break of who my mother really was to me. And I went back into those journal entries and said, all of these entries have a negative undertone to them. They have a negative perspective on them. Why? Why am I framing what's happening externally outside of me as an artist and putting it on who I am as an individual when I know that I'm not these things? What is this? What is this? It's the trauma. It's my trauma. So how can I let people know that these unhealed traumas, these things that we don't talk about, will set itself up into you and live a life of its own while you're trying to craft something you think is positive? It's taking you in a completely different direction because it's either to protect you or to shield you, and you're not able to be completely open. And so that's how I married the two together. I was scared as hell to put this book out. And the one word, like I shared with you before, that I could say once I told the world on social media that it's coming out was exposure. I felt completely exposed. And that exposure caused me to go inward. And I began to eat everything in sight, gained 35 pounds in 2.5 months. Just all of the, oh, what are people going to say? I'm embarrassed. It's disgusting. How are people going to look at me? Are people going to look at me with, oh, I'm so sorry eyes, or, oh my God, that's amazing that you powered through. I didn't know. But to answer the question, that's how it all came about. I had a coworker that said that I should write a book because of the experiences that I had. She didn't know anything about any of the trauma that I had gone through. And I always attribute that to God, the God that I serve. I always say he speaks to me, or she speaks to me the way that I listen. Or they, yes. Speak to me the way that I listen. You know, it can be something simple from a little baby I've never met before turning to me and calling me mommy and reaching out like, oh my God, this is, what is this? What does this mean? So, yeah, that's a long-winded answer for you.
Yeah. No, it's great. I love it. I want to dive into, so this being afraid, being exposed, because I definitely went through that too. And one of the things that stopped me from speaking out for a long time was like guilt and confusion in my case about my family, right? Because my family also did like a lot of great, I have a lot of great experiences, but then there was also harm done. So, so it's like, how do you balance the two? And so my first book was interviews, and everybody had fake names, so including my story. So even in a way, still hiding, still protecting the family, because, you know, you're not supposed to tell family secrets, especially in communities of color, for all the reasons that people know now. You talked about the expectations that were put on you as a child. And so I'm thinking, was this once you were taken out of your mother's home and you went to be with your other family, with your father's family, where you were like almost like a golden child in a way?
Yes. So growing up, I always felt like a golden child. And my great grandmother is actually on my mother's side. That's the one that I lived with the majority of the time. But my father's family lived literally around the corner. So I was back and forth, back and forth. But the one that I really laid my head down with every night was my great grandmother, Minnie Lee. And she is my mother's grandmother. But anywho, she would always tell me growing up, you're the only one that listens. You're the only one that listens. So she would pour into me. There will be days when we would sit there with complete silence, neither one of us talking, no TV, no radio, just sitting in space with one another. And then there will be times when she would have the baseball playing on the old school radio, and then she'll go into a memory and just start sharing that memory with me. There will be little statements or things to live by, like, you know, live your life, always have fun, be happy, but don't be stupid. That she would pour into me. She would always say, and Elizabeth is the name I was born with. She would always say, Elizabeth, there's always going to be somebody prettier, smarter, more talented than you. So you always have to do the best that you can do. She would always say that to me. And that was almost like a freeing sense, like, okay, it's not just me, and not to be so hard on myself, but of course I was. But it was just, and I think it was because I was the one who listened. Mm-hmm. And then on my father's side of the family, I was the real quiet one, because a lot of my cousins were loud and rambunctious and liked to have a lot of fun. And on my father's side of the family, I've always felt more comfortable. I always felt more shielded. I always knew that if I needed to tell them anything, they would handle it to the 10th degree. So I shielded a lot from them out of protecting them and their safety and their freedom, because I know what they could do. Mm-hmm. So I really always felt comfortable with them. And whenever I would come around, they made me feel almost like a superstar of the family. I received so much love from them, so much care from them, so much interest into what I have going on and what I'm doing. And so I have so many beautiful memories with so many people in my family that it also made it difficult to even accept that I was receiving the abuse that I was receiving.
I want to get woo-woo for a minute.
Okay.
Because people who know me, it's like, it's not just a minute, but there's something my friends and I have been talking about very much offline, but we're going to bring that conversation online. I want to hear what you think about this being a gifted child, being a golden child, being a light. I could see the light through the screen. And I've been thinking about the people that I know that are survivors of childhood sexual assault, like myself, the people who have experienced domestic violence, like myself. And it's like, it's never the person you think it is, right? They're always like, I can't imagine that would have happened to you. I can't imagine. And so I've been pondering this thing about coming into this earth plane with a light, as the light, as a being that is connected to spirit in a very different way than a lot of the frequency of earth, right? Mm-hmm. Earth school. And there's something to me about the use of domestic and sexual violence as a tool to attempt to extract that light, to kill that light, to smash the divine feminine. I've been just like, especially with everything happening in the country, the absolute attacks, right, on LGBT folk, right? And so I'm just looking at it sort of zooming out and being like, this feels like an attack on the divine feminine. This feels like an attempt to siphon energy. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. 110%. And I'm glad that you brought that up. Okay. I say this to my best friend all the time. I have a girlfriend who I've been, and she's the one who wrote the foreword of the book. Okay. We've been friends since 2001. So that's 24 years. Hmm. And I say to her all the time, whenever you are a light, because I consider her to be a light as well. Mm-hmm. When you are a light, you will find yourself going into these spaces with people that purposefully try to dim it. Mm-hmm. That is their ultimate objective. That's what they do. And you have to be able to recognize that that's what they're there for. They're doing their job. Mm-hmm. You know how like there are some people that come along your path and they're meant, like that lady who told me to write a book. There are some people that come along in your path and drop nuggets for you to move forward. They're doing their job, but you have to recognize that they are doing their job and not allow them to dim your light. I think it's so interesting, though, that you paired it with a frequency and an energy here on the plane of Earth. And so that, to me, just solidifies what I was saying to her. And I want to read more into that. You know, it's almost like back in the day when people didn't have GPS or a map or didn't know how to go, they went by the stars, right? Or they went by where the sun was facing or what have you. That's energy that is here on the earth plane. And so then the energies and the frequencies that are created within us when it comes down to our spirit and who we are internally, to the truth and the core of who we are, also reflects out. Mm-hmm. It's like a sonic wave. What's the wave that they have that the dolphins go by?
Yeah.
That.
Sonar.
Yeah. So sonar. Yeah. So I agree. 110%.
Yeah. Like if we're all energy, and this thought process is something that's helped me to put what's happened to me in a way that makes sense to me. And it's something that I've also seen working with survivors for like 24 years is that, that we feel that our spirit is damaged. But one of the things that I've seen in my work is that the spirit actually can never be damaged. It's our mind and it's our perception and it's the feeling of those things that happen to us, but the spirit itself is untouched. And so that's why I see it as, everybody's doing their job. And that helped me to like depersonalize the assault also. Like if we look at it, like everybody's doing our job. We're all on this earth school. It's not personal. It feels personal because it's happening to our bodies.
Because it's happening to our bodies. I love that. That goes back to, right. That goes back to what my therapist would always say to me, external versus internal, right? Yeah. So those that are doing something to you that are outside of you, there's nothing that you can do about that. That has nothing to do with you. That is external, internal. What are you, how are you internalizing it?
Yes.
That's what you have control over.
Yes.
And it's easier said than done. That comes with a lot of work. It comes with a lot of reflecting. It comes with a lot of grace and patience with self. But that is also a part of the work that I've been doing on my journey of mental wellness. And that's what I call it. Because at first I would always say January 19th, 2022 was the day my mind broke, but my mind did not break. It woke up. It woke up. I now understood the relationship that I had with someone whom I love so much. Okay. Now everything else is making sense. And I always ask myself, I reflect daily on how and I deal with my students. I reflect on conversations that I have with parents all the time. Like, did I really express myself in a way that was of truth and kindness, or was I coming from a space of survivor? Was I coming from a space of trauma? Where am I coming from in this moment? And there are still some moments when I am responding from trauma. There are still some times when I am triggered and, you know, and I respond in a way. And at first, because this is now year three of my mental awakeness, at first I used to beat myself up so bad and cry so hard, like, oh, it's because of this that I'm so mean sometimes, or da-da this and da-da that, that I had to develop a sense of kindness and grace for myself to understand. You went through all this for umpteenth years. It's going to take you probably that much or half of that time to get on a path of complete wellness and just understanding that. Be kind to yourself.
Absolutely. Yes. Because we are constantly unraveling. And so that was one of the things I was talking about on one of my story times that may or may not will have been aired by the time yours airs, is that for a while I would count how many years like I lived outside of violence. Right. So at this point, it's like where I am now, my age now, it's like the first half of my life was some kind of violence was happening. And so when I was like, I don't know, 40, I look back and I was like, wow, it's been like 3 years since I had no kind of violence in my life, right? Mm-hmm. And we're talking emotional, verbal, like it doesn't always have to be physical or just the violence that people can do to each other. So I would mark like the amount of time that I was away from the violence. So,
and that's a celebration and an anniversary and a birthday and 100%. A yay.
Right.
Yes.
So one of the other things that stuck with me was how during all of these things were happening to you, you never lost your creativity. You leaned into performance, writing, storytelling. How do you think the arts first saved you?
It saved my life in regards to, oh, I can step outside of Elizabeth and be Sasha for the next 3 or 4 weeks. Let me dive into who Sasha is, what's happening in her life, and completely detach everything. It was almost like a numbing of the mind. Just detach whatever's going on with me and go and live into the world of this character. But what was always so interesting is that I was always so attracted to characters that somewhat had a life like I did. Mm-hmm. And it was bleeding into one another. Uh-huh. And I didn't put two and two together until I got to this space that I'm in now, right? Yeah. But I was like, oh yeah, let me live in this world. So it was a mental thing to try to get myself outside of what I was experiencing while it was still carrying into the work that I was doing. Also, when people would see me perform roles that have any type of connection to my real life, it's adulation. It's, oh my God, that was so great. It was almost like you were outside of yourself. And the entire time I'm thinking, but that is probably me that I'm showcasing and able to put a different face and a different name to it, and people not be able to say or poke at, oh, what happened to you?
Were you conscious of it? Because sometimes trauma is like something you put in a suitcase and you just kind of carry it along with you subconsciously. Were you conscious of things, or did you kind of?
The one thing that really used to stick out to me, and my husband can attest to this, is whenever I would have successes, it was never enough. I would never be happy or revel in that success. It would be like, okay, what's next? Let's move on. I gotta keep going. I would never sit still long enough to enjoy it. Because as long as I keep busy and I keep moving forward, then I will not give my mind time to sit here and connect the dots. So let me just keep going. And that's why I say in the book, you know, the silence is the most, it's not damaging, but the most awakening part for me in this journey. Because I really had to sit with everything that happened and how that happening created certain responses that I was doing in the world and shifted perspectives for me, if that makes any sense. So yeah, I was conscious of it.
Yeah.
And was not ready, prepared, or even knew how to address it or take care of it at that time until January 19th, 2022. I knew it was time to get it together or I would no longer be here. This conversation would not be happening. It was just that dire.
Yeah.
It was either take care of thyself or we're done.
Yeah. 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 So silence is not dangerous, folks.
No.
Sometimes you need an accompaniment. You need a therapist to help you navigate the silence. But yeah, silence is not dangerous. And that is why our society keeps us busy so that we don't stop and think and learn how to get free.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Folks, 100%. I'm getting ready to have some lemon water. Drink your water.
It's good for your soul. Yes. Do you diffuse it with cucumbers as well? And mint?
No, I used to. I haven't had cucumbers. I've been eating a lot of pickles though.
Oh, okay.
So I guess I haven't eaten pickles. Yeah. But, cucumbers, but yeah, I've been eating a lot of pickles, but I haven't had cucumbers since I got to Montreal, which is weird.
Oh, okay.
Because they do have them at the grocery store. But usually I do slices of lemon or lime. I usually keep it to those two things.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but I just like to prompt people to drink. Yeah. Especially when we're having conversations like this, because it can bring up things for people who've experienced the things that we have. So
yeah,
take a break, have a sip. So I feel like you've already talked about this in the book and where you talk about art wasn't enough. You had to go deeper. Was that the 2022 moment? And did you seek out therapy at that point, or were you already?
100%. So January 1922 happened. I called a really close girlfriend of mine who I've been talking to, recently about some things that I was experiencing. I've been dropping some stuff on her, and I called her in a complete distressed moment. She was on the plane. This is when I go back to God, you know, just being everything and anything that I need at the moment. She was on the plane, just about to turn her phone on airplane mode. And I was completely distressed and distraught and was like, this just happened. She said, you need to talk to, she said the person's name. Here's his phone number. I will call you as soon as I land. I'll land in like 3 hours, but call this person right now. And she had to go. And I texted that individual, and we were on the phone within a week. And what's so interesting is that it wasn't a woman. Mm-hmm. It was a Black man mm-hmm. who I credit for saving my life. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because he kept it a buck, 100 with me. And that's the type of people that I need in my life. Like, don't sugarcoat shit with me. Mm-hmm. Tell me what it is. Who and what is this that I'm going through? And the fact that he was able to understand me as a Black woman being from the South, you know, just that connection automatically. Yeah. And then being able to pull in the academic way of therapy. So he was using things from all different forms. It wasn't just, oh, we're only going to stay on Freud or anything mm-hmm. of that sort. It was pulling from everywhere. Mm-hmm. Was brilliant for me. So I did not talk to a therapist. I talked to a psychotherapist. So they're different. Mm-hmm. They're different. So with the psychotherapist, they go deep into the soul. They really go in there. I've had an experience with therapy in grad school, and I felt like that was the most surface conversation I could ever have. It was me primarily talking and the person just asking me, well, how do you feel? Well, hell, horrible. Like, right. you know, but not giving me an insight on how I've even developed those feelings. And that's what psychotherapy provided for me. Okay, well, you went through this. This is why you're feeling this way. And that's what I needed. That was the disconnect for me on understanding why I'm feeling this way, why I'm thinking this way, why I'm loving this way, why I'm hating this way. What is this? What is this? What is this? So yeah, I had to. And I was in psychotherapy for a full 10 months.
Okay.
And then we were able to successfully end that relationship. And I say successfully because he would say to me throughout the process, you're doing all of the work. You're sounding stronger. Your eyes are brighter. I hear more strength in you. You're doing the work. You're not supposed to be in therapy for years. Mm. If you're really doing the work, then you are moving forward. Mm. You're moving through. And then he would also say to me often, remember when you go out into the world that you're not a therapist. I said, yes, why are you saying that? And he said, because once you tell your story, people are going to want to know all of the steps to do it. But at the end of the day, they still need to seek a licensed professional. So I say that all the time when I'm talking to people, speak to a licensed professional. I can tell you what I did for me.
Right.
But you know, you need to speak to somebody else to help you out. But yeah, he did make that note to me. He was like, people are going to want the sauce of what you did.
Yes.
But you did everything that you were supposed to do to get to where you are right now. And I think what he was really saying was like, as a licensed professional, they will be able to tell if the other person is not doing what they need to do or be able to give them pointers of what they need to get to where they're trying to go. And I can't do that at all. I can only share my story and what I've done and what I'm still doing on a daily basis, daily reflecting, daily.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the book, you talk about these undescribable and at times debilitating thoughts of negativity can and will and be the end of your drive if you allow it.
Yeah.
How did you deal with those thoughts and what kept you going?
Therapy, psychotherapy helped me with that. Okay. So when he asked me, how do you see yourself? There was a good 5 minutes of crying before I could answer it. And then I said that I see myself as unworthy, not valued, all of the negative things that you can think of.
Sure.
And he said, why?
Okay.
No, he didn't go to why. He said, now I want you to think about where you are right now. And my assignment was to write a letter to 5-year-old me when my abuse began. And so I had to write that letter to 5-year-old me. And then at our next session, I told him about that letter. And my response was, I think I was so hard on myself because it was also part of a survival thing. Like, if I remain so strict on myself, then I would never stop and I would never give up. And I just have to be better and perfect everything so that nobody would see the truth of the pain and the hurt that I am going through. Mm-hmm. So with therapy and understanding that that's where it was coming from, it's just been a lot easier. And I always go back to, oh, that's external. That has nothing to do with me. So when I audition for something and I don't get it, and then I look on TV and see who they cast, I go, oh, I didn't get that because they wanted someone that looked like that. It had nothing to do with my talent, nothing to do with me. I'm good. I'm good. Mm-hmm. And so those self-talks of positivity to me is a must at this point. I do not allow myself to speak negatively to me anymore. I just don't allow it. Just like I don't allow toxicity in my life anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't care how long we've been in relationship with each other. If you're bringing toxicity or any type of pain to me, I'm releasing you. I say that to myself all the time. We're not going to do that. And I talk to myself like I'm talking to another person. Elizabeth, get it together. You know? Mm-hmm. So that's what has worked for me. I don't allow it.
Okay.
I don't. Yeah.
Okay, I'm changing it from mic drop, because that's been used.
Okay. Okay.
Tools for Living, LJ's Tools for Living. That could be your next book. So,
okay.
So Tools for Living number 4, doesn't matter how long they've been in your life, if they're bringing toxicity, they've got to go. Tools mm-hmm. for Living number 4. So, and I may have missed one.
Okay.
There's a lot of knowledge dropped. So,
oh, thank you.
So before we continue, I just want to take a moment for anybody who's listening who might feel activated or overwhelmed by this conversation. So we're going to do an exercise like we always do. So I'm going to just invite you, unless you're driving. I was talking to somebody yesterday and they were like, I was just about to, you know, you just got to the part where you said, close your eyes, and I was in the car. So, so don't do this if you're in the car, please, folks. So go ahead and you know the drill by now. Go ahead and let your feet be firmly planted on the ground. Let your shoulders drop. Let the top lid fold over the bottom lid. Take a deep belly breath. So let that stomach get bigger. We're always trying to suck those stomachs in, but as you inhale, let that belly get big. And as you exhale, pull that belly in like you're almost trying to let it touch your spine, pushing the air out of your mouth. Inhale in through the mouth, belly is big. Exhale through the mouth, belly comes back to the spine. And let's just take a moment. Maybe go ahead and bring your chin to your chest. And just say thank you to yourself, to your heart. Thank you to yourself for showing up anyway. You did something right. You are here. You're in community with us in this conversation. You're here. Thank you to yourself for showing up anyway. And maybe saying silently or out loud, I am safe in this moment. I am not what grieves me. I am safe in this moment. I am not what grieves me. Taking another deep breath in, this one, take it in through the mouth. Exhale through the nose, maybe with a nice ha. And then when you're ready, open your eyes.
That was nice.
Good. We like a little break. We like a little breath break here.
Yes, that was really nice.
So I have a few more questions for you about like bringing your past and your present together. So you've been in a long-term relationship, as you said. You're a mom. Can you talk about what parts of yourself did you have to sort of ignore, if you did, to fulfill those roles? And what parts of you have you reclaimed?
So there's all, I've always wanted to be a mother. I've always wanted to be married. With those roles and those titles, I don't think anyone could ever know the amount of responsibility and accountability that come with them. But that was something that I've always wanted. I've always wanted a husband and I've always wanted children. In my relationships with my husband and my children, I definitely give all of me to them, released anything that I wanted to be sure that they're happy. And that's another survivor thing, right? As long as you're happy and you're good. I'm really good at doing that too. I'm really good at making other people feel seen. I'm really good at making people feel wanted and needed. And it wasn't until my mental awakening that I realized that I need to start pouring that into myself. Mm-hmm. And so I say that aloud, even to my little six-year-old, my little baby. She's like, come play with me. I'm like, no, I need a moment to myself. It's my time. It's me time. It's me time. And she has come to respect that.
Yeah.
She has come to respect that. My oldest daughter definitely has come to respect that. My husband, he's respecting it. Mm-hmm. He's getting there, but he understands it. And the way that my family loves me and gives me the space that I need is something that I could never, it's something money can't buy. It's something that I really can't formulate into words, but they give me everything that I need. Mm-hmm. And they've been on this journey with me. I've been very open and vocal with my oldest daughter on what has happened to me. I've told my youngest baby, you know, my mother and I, we don't have a relationship like you and I. I'm very open with her. She, of course, she doesn't know about the abuse or, or stuff like that at this point. She's too young for that. And my youngest baby is more of an empath like I am, meaning I can be very descriptive with her and she will break into, you know, complete emotional meltdown because she can see it, she can feel it. And so I'm very careful on what I share with her. Very careful, very careful. But yeah, so because I was already in that survival world of making others feel great, I would say attributed to the success of my relationship with my husband and as being a mother. But that mental awakening is when I said, okay, now I need to start doing that to me too. And I do that. I go get my nails done. I be sure to buy myself some nice perfume. I'll sit in silence, in a space of silence, and just be one with my thoughts positively. If I want to go to sleep at 1 o'clock in the afternoon because my body is feeling tired, I'll go to sleep at 1 o'clock in the afternoon because my body is feeling tired, and not beating myself up like, oh no, we need to go and write this, or we need to, no, I don't want to do anything today. And I won't do anything. Oh, that was difficult though. It was hard. I don't want to make it seem like it was something like a flick of the switch, because it wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't. And my husband would always say to me, I'm so glad you're taking care of yourself. So they can see it too. Yeah. And I've asked my oldest daughter, I'm like, since I've been in therapy, I asked her this, I think a year and a half ago, since I've been in therapy, have you noticed any difference in me? And she said, let me try to remember everything. But she said, you have more energy. God, it was so beautiful. She was like, you have more energy. Yeah, you're not as, the time and energy that my family gives to me when I need to give to myself is beautiful. I remember asking my oldest daughter, and I'm gonna try my best to remember everything that she said, but I asked her about a year and a half ago, since I had done psychotherapy, has there been anything different about me? Mm. And she says, you have more energy. You're not quick to anger, been more open. So I'm like, okay, it's working. And there was a couple of other things. I think she said five whole points. But for Mother's Day last year, she wrote me this beautiful letter as my Mother's Day gift. And one of the lines in it that I absolutely love was how she said that she's so proud of me for doing the work. And yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Because she's been through it, boy. She's seen it all. She's 14 now.
Okay.
So she has seen when, you know, the anger that's just so illogical comes up. And one of the things that I do with my children that I never got growing up was taking accountability for how I can show up in space with them. And I will come back real hard. Like, I am so sorry. I apologize to my children heavily if I've done something wrong. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to yell. I didn't mean to get so upset. I'll do better. I'm working on it. You know, and having that type of relationship with my daughters, having the relationship with my daughters that I wish that I had growing up has been very, very, very beneficial. Mm-hmm. So just sitting around and having conversations, talking about their day, talking about what they're going through, what crushes do we have? You know, what do you want to do when you get older? What are you interested in right now? What are you reading? I never got that from my mother. And so just really forming that bond and that relationship with my girls is something that I look forward to.
Great.
And I love it. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I want to zoom out from your story and talk about something, again, like wider. Your experience, but outside your experience. So one of the things that I was thinking about when I was like reading your book and thinking about, you know, what we were going to talk about today, I was thinking about our most brilliant artists, you know, Hendrix, Aretha Franklin, Kurt Cobain, like Marilyn Monroe, one of my favorites, even like Demi Moore, who's like having this amazing renaissance right now. They she all is. Come from, and even Quincy Jones, like, I don't know if you've seen Quincy Jones's documentary on Netflix.
I haven't.
Fabulous.
Okay, I'll check it out.
They all came from extremely traumatic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. You know, Quincy Jones, yeah, I think his mother, like, tried to take him off the planet when he was a little kid. Like,
okay.
Yeah, she would have episodes.
Okay.
And so, and again, Aretha Franklin, like Kurt Cobain, all these folks, they have these, you know, very challenging backgrounds, and many of whom wound up separating from their parents. Like, I know Demi Moore completely estranged from her mom. What do you think it is about pain that creates artists?
Well, we need to find something to make us feel alive. Mm. Pain doesn't make us feel alive. Pain makes us feel like we're just here. We're just existing rather than living. It's like, it has to be something more to life than this. I see that person over there laughing and smiling and living their best life. I see this person over there laughing and smiling and living their best life. Why am I not? What is that? What do they have that I don't?
Mm.
And the arts can help you find that, can help you find truth to the beauty of life, can help you smell flowers literally differently. Art can help you walk into the world and be more observant and be more appreciative of everything that's around you. Because in order for you to pour into the art, you first must be receptive of everything around you and the beauty of it. And I think that's why so many of us go that way. But one thing I always used to say to myself is, I refuse to be the tragic artist. Yeah. I refuse to allow all of that pain to take me out. I refuse. And like I said in the book, I've always had the tenacity to live. I just didn't know how.
The tenacity to live.
Mm-hmm.
Because you spoke about art not being enough. And if I think about, and I didn't even think about it when I like, we're thinking about these artists, because goodness knows there's so many of them. I mean, Natalie Cole, I mean, there's so many, Janis Joplin, like, there's just, like, yeah, the list goes on and on. Right. Yeah. And you yourself said the art wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. And for me as well, the mm-hmm. art wasn't enough. We had to have that spirituality too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Aretha Franklin, when she came out of her addiction, she went back to, you know, religion.
Right, to religion. I'm quick to tell people immediately, like, okay, yeah, my great grandmother, she used to take me to church all the time, First Baptist Church in Pritchett, Alabama. Mm-hmm. We would go all the time, every Sunday and every summer, she would have me in vacation Bible school. So, but there was always something about religion yeah. that made me feel. It always goes down back to history too. Like there's something off here. There's a disconnect here. And I didn't understand what that was until I started doing the self-work on myself. I've always had a deep connection with God. Yes. But a lot of the other things that come along with it, it comes across as hypocritical. It comes across as judgmental. It comes across as cruel and evil. And I'm like, I just can't see how an entity of all knowing and creation would be cruel. I don't feel that. I don't see that. I don't connect to that. So I had to distance myself from religion mm-hmm. and really dive into the spirituality of who I am and connecting to the humanity of it all. And I just don't connect with the word. And I have a quote in the book by Ayanla Van Zant, and she says it perfectly, and I don't remember it verbatim, but she states how religion is the customs that man puts on the word, and spirituality is more so of connecting with the divinity and the truth and the realness of who we are. And that's where I am. I'm in that world.
Yeah.
I'm not like, oh, well, you know, you do this, then you're not a Christian. I can't.
Yeah.
That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. To me. Absolutely. To me. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And this theme will be repeated, listeners. This theme will be repeated throughout the podcast. So, you know, prepare yourself because yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if you all listened to my bonus episode that came out April 11th called Church Girls on the Brink. Which is a set of interviews that I did with Black women about Black women and high demand religions and cults. That dropped on April 11th. So if you haven't seen it, if you haven't read it, if you haven't heard it yet, go back and listen to it.
Yeah.
Because we get into that a lot.
Good.
So
good.
That's one of my favorite conversations. So LJ, thank you so much. So my last question that I've started asking people is, what are you grieving and what are you grateful for?
I am grateful. I want to start with that one. I am grateful for a lot of things. But primarily I'm grateful for forgiveness. And when I speak about forgiveness, I mean forgiving me. I forgive myself. I forgive myself for loving the abuser, the puppeteer of it all. I forgive myself for not allowing it to happen, but thinking that I allowed it to happen. I forgive myself. So I am grateful that I've been able to arrive to that space of love and kindness for me. I will forever grieve the relationship that I've always yearned for with my mother. I will forever grieve that because it didn't exist and I wanted it so bad. So yeah, that's that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing, for trusting me with your story. And
thank you.
You know, giving me your book to read for this conversation. And how can people support you? How can people support your work, your art? How can they find you?
Thank you. And, you know, I've taken a break as an artist. I took a break throughout this journey of mental wellness. And I'm just now getting back to the space where I'm like, you know, it's time. It's time to get back in front of the camera. But you, yeah, you can support the book, The Invention of LJ. It is available right now on Amazon. I have two different versions. I have the paperback and I have the hard cover. And then I also have different versions of standard print versus HD print, I think is what it's called, like high print as far as the color go. But it's all there on Amazon. My website is ljstewart.com, that's ELLEJAE, and then Stewart, STEWART.com. So I keep that updated. But I have a couple of ideas in mind in regards to my next film project that I want to do. And so if you just go to that website, and my socials are the exact same thing. Everything is the same across the board, LJ Stewart, on Instagram and Facebook. And so I'll start posting about that once I'm ready. And the next thing that I am working on as of within the next couple of weeks, really, is doing the audiobook for The Invention of LJ, because I've had quite a few people ask for that. And it's been a year since I've released the book. And I am now starting to feel, or not starting, I do feel more comfortable with reading the words on a microphone. Okay. So that's the next thing that's about to come out with the book, and I'm going to do more marketing with the book now as well, and then start working on this film project that I have in mind, and
okay,
take it from there. Yes.
Okay. Exciting. So, yeah, this was so good. What a great conversation. Again, just thank you for trusting me. And, you know, if this conversation has touched you all as much as it's touched me, you know, I want to hear from you. I want Come to the Brink to be an actual space for connection and not just consumption. Okay. We're not just consumers over here. Like, interact with me, interact with LJ. Follow her on the socials, buy the book. And so I also have some questions for you all to think about as you listen to this podcast. What part of LJ's stories mirrored your own? And what's your relationship to your own story? And what helped you hold on? And so, yeah, next week, we're going to dive even deeper into the unseen. We're going to sit with a Black medium who communicates directly with the ancestors. We are going to talk about how mediumship works, how it helps with grief, and how the grief of communities lives in our bones. So this episode is going to be for anybody who's ever wondered if they're truly alone and what might guide them on the other side of the silence. And again, if this conversation LJ and I had touched you in any way, leave me a comment or a message or a voice note. I like voice notes too. Because as I always say, none of us need to be on the brink alone. I'm Zoe Flowers, and I'll see you soon. Bye.
Thank you.